Happy Thanksgiving and welcome to Fairbanks Arts Review. Coming up, a look at gift books for the holidays, A Servant of Two Masters, and Alaskaland Cinema. I'm Robert Gilfil, and hoping you'll join me for that and A Movable Feast tonight on Fairbanks Arts Review. With Christmas just around the corner and practically nothing bought for anyone, I dropped by Baker & Baker Booksellers and asked owner Lynn Baker what titles she could recommend as gifts.
Maurice Sendak's Nutcracker is finally available. From doing the ballet last year in Seattle, he's taken the background that he did then and put it in book form, and I just want to say it's gorgeous. I never know what to expect when you see a new book build. This is ready to come out. This one, I got to say, I'm more than pleased with. There's another fun book, too. The Hobbit has been illustrated by Michael Haig this year, and it's a bit large, oversized volume, I don't think overpriced, and just full of his lavish illustrations. Another one, which a lot of you people probably remember, was a book called A Day in the Life of Australia, which came out 2 years ago. And what they do is take the film crew, drop them in Australia with all the film that they can shoot. That book was beautiful. And this year they've done A Day in the Life of Hawaii.
Does it measure up to the first book's style? Because I remember seeing that, and it was a beautiful book.
I think it's above. I think the photographers really had a great time doing that, and then they set out to do even better when they did this one. And I know with everyone who up here who spends half the year in Hawaii anyway, it'll bring back a lot of memories. Australia was great because that's where everyone wants to go, but Hawaii seems to be everyone's second home. In fact, we were talking about how I feel like I'm always apologizing when I say I haven't been there yet. You know, it's almost like, well, where have you been? One more pretty one that I'm excited about is a Leonardo da Vinci pop-up book, in which we have a lot of his early inventions and pop-ups that they've made from his sketches. Wow. It's a fun book.
A Leaning Tower of Pisa, too.
That really does lean sometimes. And that was it for pretty gift books that you can also enjoy yourself. We've got a lot of short stories being released this time of year. And they've held back on short stories for a while because they didn't sell, and maybe this is the time they want to put them out. Mentioned briefly, there's a new Sylvia Townsend Warner of Lolly Willows, for those of you who remember. E.L. Doctorow, Lives of the Poets. That's a good idea. Elizabeth Bishop, The Collected Prose, is now available in a paperback edition. And Gabriel Garcia Marquez has a new book out, and it is collected short stories.
Now, these aren't new stories that he's written, but ones that have appeared in other collections before, and they've been assembled in this hardback edition?
That's correct, yeah.
I see on the table here something that I remember from my San Francisco 60s days, the Alice B. Toklas cookbook. Only now it's been legitimized by M.F.K. Fisher's introduction.
When I was first told about this book, I was real excited. Just to see it back, it's so much fun. Was told that the original brownie recipe is in it. Was also told by the sales rep, Lynn, don't go heavy on this book because it probably won't sell. I think he's wrong. It's a lovely book. It's well jacketed. A lot of good recipes in there. I think you can even use it. So, another cookbook that's out too. It's a book called Eating Together, Recollections and Recipes. It's by Peter Fiebelman with Lillian Hellman, and he discusses a lot of the things that they cook together, puts a lot of good recipes, and shares a lot of the dinners they had together. It looks like a lot of fun, and I can't say much about this one either because this was just unpacked about half an hour ago. So,
are there any novels that you recommend for people that they might take a look at?
One I think a lot of people are going to be real happy to see is Tom Robbins has a new book out called Jitterbug Perfume. It has something to do with a bottle that has the spirit of life in it that's slowly seeping away, and we're down to a couple drops, and Tom Robbins is going to tell us how to get it all back together, but I think that'll be a biggie. There are a lot of Tom Robbins fans around. Ivan Doig is another writer who is really popular up here. I have not read anything of Doig. His new book is English Creek. His most popular probably is Winter Brothers or House of Sky. And this one is set in Montana, the outdoors, and it's Ivan Doig's special way of saying things.
We just got a press release that Michener is coming up here.
to write a book about Alaska. I have an idea. It'll probably be called Alaska. I mean, he likes those pithy titles like Hawaii or...
Alaska should be good, yeah. In fact, hopefully the University of Alaska Press is going to get itself back together, start publishing some books. I've been talking to one of the girls who's now working up there, suggesting titles that are now out of print, basic things like Dictionary of Alaska Place Names or a Guide to Alaska Wildlife, Flowers. You've got a good wolf book. She was going to write a letter to James Michener and ask if he'd be willing to go with the University of Alaska Press. And I don't know if she'd ever heard back from that Dear Jim letter she was going to go. But that should be exciting, as long as he doesn't talk to Lisa Burnback, who did the college guide. Yeah, I hope there's no communication.
So what other things? Something about F. Scott Fitzgerald, do I see?
New biography, James Mello, author of Charmed Circle, which I thought was an excellent book, Gertrude Stein. So if he does the same thing with F. Scott Fitzgerald and Zelda, it should be an excellent book. This one, too, is brand new and was in last night. I've been waiting for this one, though, since August. They finally got it packed and shipped, and it looks like a good read.
And another Antonia Fraser.
Mm-hmm. The Weaker Vessel is a history of women. Women in the 17th century England, on and on and on. This one has been selling pretty well. It's a lot of interest, and she's so good. A new D.M. Thomas from White Hotel, which I personally did not like, and I don't know if Swallow will be good. There are a lot of D.M. Thomas fans. I just can't read him. I'm going to push say the mystery section is there. An Armful of Mysteries is a great idea. And I've had more fun reading mysteries the past couple months because I can actually get through them, have a lot of fun with reading them. And I'm recommending Charlotte McLeod right now. We have about six of her titles. She's witty. The characters are in them all are just great. And then she does have the mystery running, you know, who killed who and why. And she's not easy to guess. And you have, I think you get,
ask.
Yeah, she's not easy to guess. She twists it all up at the end, but she gets so wrapped up in her characters that half the time I forget what I'm trying to solve anyway and just wait for the ending to come.
It seems like a good selection of books. Tom Robbins, The Hobbit, and a new edition with new illustrations. I saw those illustrations. Those really were quite attractive. Mm-hmm. And The Nutcracker by Sendek.
Mm-hmm.
And the Leonardo da Vinci pop-up book, the Hawaii book, and, of course, all the novels and short stories out. Is there one book that you seem to sell more of during Christmas time than any other? I've always wanted to ask that. What was probably the biggest selling
probably
book?
Probably Kaya Gabran's The Prophet is still one of the biggies at Christmas.
Really?
And for children's books, we have a book called The Best Christmas Pageant Ever, which year after year we just sell out of.
I see you have a bestseller up there, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. Well, thank you, Lynn, for running down some of the new titles that you've received and some ideas for gifts for people this season.
Thanks a lot, Robert, for coming by.
That was Lynn Baker of Baker & Baker Booksellers discussing some of the titles appropriate as gifts for the holidays. The university's drama department is busy this week and next. Their production, Servant of Two Masters, opens next Friday, and auditions for the next show, Agnes of God, will be taking place December 4th and 5th. And no one is busier than Ken Risch. He's the director of both dramas, and I stopped by his office yesterday finding him remarkably composed. I asked him,
what's it like as a director handling a large cast? Does it present problems for you that, let's say, something, and I understand you'll be directing Agnes of God, which is following another university production directly after Servant of Two Masters, which only has two women in it, I believe, three women in it, and that's a small, intimate piece. What kind of problems and dynamics do you face as a director with a large cast?
Particularly with a large cast like this, which for most of the play, quite a number of them are on stage, it's difficult to make sure that you give enough attention to every person that's on stage. You try to center in on those who are the most mobile and those who carry the bulk of the lines, and you have to keep reminding yourself that the other people on stage must create their own life. They can't become part of the scenery, and so it's difficult to keep on top of 8 or 10 people at one time and make them all active and all involved.
One of the techniques that I saw one director use at a certain point in blocking scenes with large cast, they'd have a model of the stage with little coins or something, or little figurines, and they kind of move them around like a war game. What do you use that technique, or what's your philosophy in blocking with a large cast?
When I first started doing musicals and large shows, I used to create my own little model and move stick people around. After a while, you get accustomed to being able to keep track of where individuals are, and so you really don't need to use the model technique. It does get easier. The most difficult part about it is if you can't sit down. For instance, it's difficult to block in my office, because when I'm writing down the compositions that I'm trying to create with these people, all of a sudden the phone will ring and you'll lose track of where these people are at any given moment. You'll come back 5 minutes later and have to start from the beginning of the scene and trace everything through. But generally at this point, if you know the set and you know what you're working on and the relative heights of the people, you can pretty well do it from your mind. You don't need to write anything else down.
When you say the heights of the people, that's a consideration then in blocking. I mean, that's one of the elements that you have to keep track of?
Definitely, because a taller person, a larger person, will create sight line problems depending upon where they're positioned on stage, and may block the view of the audience to another actor on stage. And you have to be very concerned about where those taller, larger people are on stage at any given moment.
Now, certain members of your cast are relatively new to the stage, maybe haven't acted before. How do you approach them as a director? What techniques, if they don't know, let's say, you can't use certain cue words that an experienced actor would know and pick up immediately and give you maybe in a performance or a type of emotion that you're looking for. How do you approach new actors when you're working with them, besides with the whip?
We have several people who have never been on the stage before, which has been real interesting, and we have some actors who have been on stage quite regularly here. It's a combined process. In the first rehearsals, what I do is I sit down and explain the basic stage directions that they will need to know and how to record those in a script. And hopefully throughout the process of, I took a particularly long time in staging this play because it's very active, and because there were so many new people, they just simply needed to get used to what blocking was all about. Hopefully through the process, they not only pick up things from what I say, but they learn from the more experienced people. And by and large, it's worked for this production. They've not hesitated to ask those who are more experienced what this means, what that means, and they have talked to me when they've had questions, which that kind of open dialogue is very helpful.
You're also a professor here. You teach classes, and you were actually just in a one-man show. Didn't you open with a one-man show? And you worked with a Guthrie. And how do you find, do you enjoy teaching? Do you yearn more to be on the stage? How do you find that balance in an artistic life between academic and actual experience?
That's a real difficult question. I left my professional career at the Guthrie to take my first university teaching job, primarily because of job security, and I had a number of debts, school loans to pay off, car debts, everyone knows about these things. And those who know anything about the theater know that it is a very uncertain profession, and you go for long periods of time where you are unemployed. I was tied financially to the point where I couldn't afford that those periods of unemployment. So I went into teaching. I had taught high school 5 years before I went back to graduate school and eventually into professional acting. I get things out of teaching. For instance, I learn a lot about the mistakes I make as an actor by working with younger actors. It's like watching a mirror image at times. And so you can control and keep in check some of the things that you do. But it is a process that change and fluctuates depending upon your mood. For instance, I went 3 years straight as a teacher and didn't do anything on stage. And I got to the point where I felt out of touch with what it was like to be on stage. And so I went back to acting and have acted in the summers since to remind myself of what that pressure is like. And then it also helps bring me back to the classroom. But it's a difficult thing for someone who enjoys doing both. to find that balance. The main thing, I guess, is feeling yourself out. When you feel frustrated as a performer, you are not going to be effective as a teacher, because then you take it out on your students. And so I vowed some time ago that if I ever get to that point, then I will either drop out of education or find an acting job so that I can get those juices and that out of my system and come back to the classroom again.
Would you talk a little bit about Agnes of God, because that's a recent play. It's only been
four years ago
on Broadway. Why did you choose Agnes of God as a production here at the university? What elements in that play intrigue you?
We have, first of all, in our season planning, we have a very large production next term with Guys and Dolls. And the general feeling was that our strength was in the females, and we needed a play that would feature the females, and that was relatively small in scale. That's one of the reasons. That's the practical side of it. I was taken with Agnes the first time I saw it with the original cast on Broadway, and the thing I like about the play is that it presents a problem and leaves the audience to solve the problem. It is controversial in terms of subject matter. It deals with science to a point, science versus religion, but really it is more all of these characters search for that connection to God, which in turn gives them their identity, each to a different degree. But the whole idea of a possible immaculate conception is quite controversial. The play is really stunning in terms of the acting challenges for the three ladies involved, and I also enjoy the intimacy of the moments. It's going to take a tremendous amount of risks from the actresses involved, and it's going to be a challenge to the audience. It's a piece that the audience should get very involved in and leave the theater questioning their own beliefs and convictions.
Well, thank you for talking with me, taking time out of what I know must be a very busy schedule, and I look forward to serving the two masters and Agnes of God.
Thanks.
Thank you.
That was director Ken Risch of the university's drama department discussing Servant of Two Masters, which opens next Friday at the university's Fine Arts Theater, and his next project, Agnes of God. Those who listen to our show or who attend the movie shown at Alaskaland know Laurel Stalky needs no introduction. She runs Alaskaland Cinema, and she stopped by the other day to run down the films that will finish out the year there.
Dodeskaden, the title, is imitating the sound of a trolley car in motion, Dodeskaden. And the film is about people living in the slums of Tokyo and their fantasies and the reality of their life, kind of woven together through the plot.
You know, a little bit about Kurosawa as a director. He originally wanted to be a painter, a Western painter, and he studied to be that in Tokyo. And I think he may have even traveled to Paris for a while. But he also read quite extensively of the Russian novelists like Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, and Gogol. And you know, one of the things he made a film about the idiot.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he always attempts to do is make the characters exquisitely human, and their travails and woes are always really poignantly drawn, and he has a keen eye in capturing that, I think.
I think so, too, and maybe that background has to do with the complexity and the development of his plots, and he gives his films time to develop. I enjoy that about it.
And I really like to see the way he uses color in his later films, for example, Dersu Uzala, which you showed last year.
Mm-hmm.
Just stunning color. And his use, he has a real keen eye. I mean, that's the painter in him, too. He always has, and you can see this in The Seventh Samurai, too, this really fine sense of composition. Each scene is composed, and sometimes the camera just resides there very with stillness.
And he has said, if you have to explain a character's motivation, then you've done more than you have to do in a film. The film needs to show it. You know, you don't have to have a timeout and someone explains in narration why they're doing something. Mm. I'm glad he does his films that way. Makes it interesting and makes it worth seeing them more than one time.
Well, I'll be looking forward to Dodeskaden.
Dodeskaden.
And that's... What are the dates on that?
That's November 26th through 28th, right after the Thanksgiving holiday, Monday through Wednesday.
Oh, great.
And our new time is 7 o'clock.
You moved it back an hour.
Yeah.
For daylight savings?
Well, no, by popular request. But I'm finding it's not too popular. Half of the crowd wants it still at 8, half at 7. But we have a lot of longer films coming up. And since we're on the weekdays and the working people need to get home, we put it to 7 o'clock.
Well, that's good to know. So 7 o'clock is when we should show up for that. And that's followed by one of my all-time favorite films. In fact, I was talking to my friend Paula the other day about how we had to see Lost Horizons because I do a Ronald Colman impression from that film.
Great. Would you do it before the show?
Really? Take this girl out of this valley and she'll fade away like an echo. Goodbye. Ronald Colman was one of my heroes when I was growing up. And this is a great film, too.
Uh-huh. Right. I want to see it for the sets, and I haven't seen this one either, but I've read about it, and the sets cost something like one half of Columbia's film budget for the entire year in 1937 was spent on this, but yet the sets have been called strangely unattractive. It looks interesting. Utopia, you know, Shangri-La, you can do a lot with that idea.
Well, James Hilton, I mean, it was a marvelous book that he wrote, but... I think that Columbia, I wasn't aware that Columbia was the company that produced it, but they really put their eggs in one basket because they have Frank Capra, who is just a dream of a director, and then they have Dmitry Tiomkin doing the score. I mean, they really, and they have small, I mean, character actors. Sam Jaffe plays the High Lama.
Yeah.
And Sam Jaffe is one of those character actors that I don't think people recognize enough, you know. He was really one of the finest actors that Hollywood brought out, but because he only did small roles, he did like Gunga Din. I guess he got typecast in native roles somehow, but he did like Gunga Din and things like that, but he was an extraordinary actor.
And Jane Wyatt, that's her first screen role in this film.
And then she went on to Father Knows Best. That's what a letdown. And, of course, Ronald Colman. And if everybody's good and goes to see the film, I won't do my impression again. And again, that's based on James Hilton's novel. And then that's followed by A Christmas Story. Now, is this the... What is this?
Well, it's a comedy. Gene Shepherd, are you familiar with his... he had a series, Gene Shepherd's America, on PBS, where he would tour around and tell... just funny little anecdotes about places and drawing on his past. He did The Phantom of the Open Hearth about growing up in a steel mill town and Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories. You haven't heard of these, Robert? Well,
no,
it's a great... He's a great humorist and author. Some of my favorite books. If you ever... Any time I have a friend who's sick or laid up in bed or in the hospital, I give him Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and... guaranteed to help them improve their spirits.
Well, that's good.
But this is a new film he did in 1983 about small town Christmas. You know, it's a, what does it say? A tribute to the original, traditional, 100% red-blooded, two-fisted, all-American Christmas. About being a little kid and wanting a BB gun for Christmas and all the things that a family Christmas involves.
Oh, well, good. Always like Christmas stories. What did you have last year? Did you have the one by Frank Capra, the one with James Stewart?
Well, we're having that this year. It's a Wonderful Life.
It's a Wonderful
coming
Life.
Up next, right?
Well, no wonder I thought of it. And I've always enjoyed that one, especially Donna Reed. She was so beautiful.
I like everything about that film. I like to see it every Christmas. And I have a book on Frank Capra, and if you can believe it, it says he views it every Christmas Eve.
He does. It just works somehow. I mean, the despair at one point in Jimmy Stewart's face is really amazing, you know? And no matter how many times I see it, I still feel for him.
I feel the same way. And if you're having trouble getting in a Christmas spirit, this is the film to see. I just love it. Maybe we should tell a little bit about the story in case people haven't seen it.
Go right ahead, yeah.
Jimmy Stewart plays a a person who's lived in a small town his whole life. He's always wanted to travel. He never got the chance. He was going to go away on a trip paid for by his father, but his father died. He had to take over the company, and his older brother took those funds, or younger brother went to college. Then he got married, so he never realized any of his dreams, but he's loved by everyone in town. And Christmas Eve, he's just about had it with small-town life, and his uncle, who's his partner, has bumbled and lost a lot of money for the company, and he's bankrupt. Jimmy Stewart decides he's going to jump off a bridge and end it all. And a guardian angel comes down. Actually, he's in the water, and Jimmy Stewart, being so nice, jumps in to save this guy, forgetting he was going to commit suicide himself a minute before. The guy turns out to be his guardian angel, who will earn his wings if he can keep Jimmy Stewart from killing himself. So he does this through showing Jimmy Stewart how his life has affected other people and how things would have been different if he had never been born. And has a great uplifting ending. And
well, just like Capra, you know.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people, I think, nowadays tend to sort of, there's a sort of a snide gesture towards Capra because of his uplifting endings, or, you know, what could be called saccharine endings. But I don't think that does him justice, you know. I think John Fowles said that it's sort of a myth of our age that an Assyrian work has to end tragically or with despair.
Mm-hmm.
And he says there's no reason why it should end that way, then it should end happily.
Mm-hmm. Well, they call that Capricorn, you know.
No, I didn't know that.
But I think he's a wonderful director.
Oh, he does, and he has so much substance to it that it isn't just saccharine, it isn't just mm-hmm. fluff. Well, let's run down quickly then the four films that we just discussed, and maybe go backwards.
Okay. Well, December 17 through 19, It's a Wonderful Life, the Frank Capra film with Jimmy Stewart and Donna Reed. Then A Christmas Story precedes that, and that's December 10 through 12, the Gene Shepherd comedy. December 3 through 5 is Lost Horizon, the Frank Capra version. And November 26 through 28 is Dodeskaden by Akira Kurosawa.
Well, thank you for stopping by. We'll see you in a month, I guess.
Yeah,
in the next
see you next
series.
Year.
Do you have any special films that you want to highlight before you leave?
Well, I'm thinking of running a series. We have a number of Sundays booked, five in a row, and I'll either go with a Truffaut retrospective and or the 15-hour Berlin-Alexanderplatz by the German director Fassbinder.
Wow.
And that comes in five parts, 3 hours each.
Wow.
And I appreciate input from people if they're interested in seeing this. I'm just wavering on booking that, because it is a five-part series and you need to see all of it.
Well, it should be interesting.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to see it.
Yeah, I've never seen it. Well, good. Well, then, people out there who are fans of Alaska Land Cinema and attend it regularly, here's a chance for you to sort of sway the decision one way or the other on upcoming films.
That's right. I appreciate people's comments.
Okay. Well, thank you, Laurel. I vote for Fassbinder. No. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
That was Laurel Stahlke of Alaska Land Cinema presenting November and December's films. And now for A Movable Feast.
Local broadcast of A Movable Feast is made possible by a grant from A Movable Feast, located at the Northgate Mall.
A Movable Feast. Hi, I'm Tom Vitale. On this program, Louis Auchincloss reads from his novel The Book Class, talks about high society in his writing and his life. Louis Auchincloss was born in 1917, brought up in New York City, and educated at Yale University and the University of Virginia Law School. In 1941, he began his career at a Wall Street law firm. Today, he's still a practicing attorney, as well as president of the Museum of the City of New York. Mr. Auchincloss is a member of the National Institute of Arts and Letters. Mr. Auchincloss has written 36 books, including nonfiction works on Henry James and Edith Wharton, and the novels The Rector of Justin, A World of Profit, and The Partners. His 27th work of fiction, The Book Class, is about a dozen wealthy women who meet once a month for over 60 years to discuss literature. And now, Louis Auchincloss reading from The Book Class.
In any sociological examination, the danger is to select a group so small as to be unrepresentative of anything, or one so large as to be meaningless. My danger will be the first, for I shall not be dealing with the South or with Boston. I shall not even be dealing with the city of New York. I am limiting myself to the skinny island of Manhattan, and to the eastern side of Central Park at that. I shall be dealing with the wives and daughters of the managers of money and industry in New York City, what is sometimes called society. And I have arbitrarily selected as representatives of this society my mother's book class. These were the dozen women who instituted it as debutantes in 1908 and met every month, except, of course, in the torrid summertime, to discuss a selected title, old or new, until the death of Cornelia Gates 64 years later. Even then, mother was not the survivor of the group. There are still three living as I write, but by the time she expired, it was felt that it was too small to go on. All 12 women were what are now called WASPs. They were white, of course, and had started life as Protestants, although two later became Catholics, and they were Anglo-Saxon, if that word be stretched, as it is by some, to embrace persons of English, Scottish, German, Scandinavian, and Swiss descent. All were listed in the New York Social Register, all were privately educated, all but one were married. Their means were more varied. Justine Bannard, Polly Travers, and mother were born rich. Milo Jessop and Lila Lee married rich men. Adeline Bloodgood was almost poor. The others were what was called comfortable, which in that group in the 1930s meant owning an apartment or a brownstone in town, a house in the country, having five or six maids, two or three cars, several clubs, and one's children all in private schools. None except Adeline ever held a regular job, although Polly Travers became an assemblywoman from a district upstate, and several held responsible Red Cross or similar posts in both world wars. What to my young observing eyes was most remarkable about the group was the extraordinary amount of service that they required from everyone else. Their mothers, who had grown up after the Civil War in an America where servants, though numerous, were not yet, thanks to immigration, numberless, had been trained to cook and sew and clean, to know, in short, the tasks that they were expected to supervise. But the girls of the book class could hardly boil water. They never had to go into the kitchen unless to inspect or give an order. They never had to darn a stocking or make a bed or clean a bathroom. As mothers, they never changed or washed a baby. Everything in the household, from marketing to cleaning, was taken off their hands. The bills were paid by their husband's secretaries, unless they happened to enjoy keeping a checkbook. All business matters, insurance, taxes, even charitable contributions, were handled downtown. Never, I earnestly maintain, in the history of the globe, has a class of human beings had so little expected of it. Their decks, so to speak, were cleared for action. They floated, magnificently equipped, clean and shining battleships, on a benign sea, ready to encounter, well, what but other battleships? What did they do, these princesses of privilege, these battle wagons in a world of peace, with all their endowments? Well, isn't the answer to that precisely the task that I have set myself? I think that all I am going to say at the outset is that they were serious. All 12 women were as serious as a jury drawn up and harangued by a judge at a murder trial. I see them staring at me now, those 24 encompassing orbs. Lila Lee, was she serious? Yes, even Lila was serious, at least at the start. and at the end, the very end. Ah, how I envied them. I saw my lot in the doomed faces of males destined to the grey death in life of Wall Street. Perhaps had I been born to a European aristocracy and seen my father and brother in pink coats riding to hounds on a crystal clear morning, or passing the port around the dining room table while their waiting wives yawned in the drawing room, I might have imagined diversions in a male future. But I could never believe that father and his fellow officers at the Gallatin Bank really enjoyed themselves. They talked too much about how hard they toiled. It seemed to me that all the fun in life had been left to the wives. When I went in to say good morning to mother on my way to school, her immunity from the dull routine inflicted on men was emphasized by her still being in bed with a breakfast tray before her, letters and papers and magazines strewn about, the cook receiving the day's order, perhaps even her secretary writing on her pad, for all the world like Ruth Draper's monologue of a society lady in the Italian lesson. And I had a vision of a morning in the back of her green Rolls-Royce, transported from shop to shop, to look at beautiful things, with lunch at the Colony Club, or better still, a French restaurant, an afternoon at a matinee, and then home to dress at leisure for a stylish dinner party. Or if it were a working day, I saw her at the head of a boardroom table, in a comfortable armchair, receiving reports from a respectful staff about the running of a nursing school or settlement house, and leaving after some perfunctory votes were taken with a benign sense of duty well done. I would be envious of my sister, knowing that when she had completed her dozen years of Miss Chapin's school, she too would be eligible for the female existence of multiple delights. But did these privileged souls ever acknowledge their privileges? Never. That was part of the game. Just as men always emphasized the grimness of their labor, though this to some extent may have been true, so did the ladies of the book class invariably maintain that they had never a free minute themselves, that they were expected to be the slaves of their households and offspring, that in entertaining they were constantly encumbered with a required guest list of their husband's business associates, and that vacation resources were selected for reasons of golf alone. They did not feel sorry for themselves. That was not their note. But they did want it known, perhaps in anticipation of the doubt in such an observer as myself, that this life was not all beer and skittles. What did they look like? Of course, they were all approaching middle age when I first started to observe them critically, but I cannot say that despite a considerable financial outlay on clothes, they did much to resist its onset. Lila Lee told me once, at 50, that she was the only member of the group that still remembered she was a woman. Had I been able to mould them into a single female, I think she would have been tall, a bit bony, brown-faced, quick-striding, abrupt and of assertive manners, but always polite to inferiors, those anyway who weren't uppity, rapid of speech, capable of hearty laughter, and wearing rather bigger jewels than might have been expected. A vulgar observer might have been tempted to use the term horsey, but it would have been exaggerated. Their marriages, on the whole, were known as happy, but it had never been their principle that a man should be snared by lures, or that once secured he should be retained by any sacrifice of candour or normal deportment. It was a man's duty, if he married at all, to marry within his social sphere, and what was that but the book class? One waited, a suitor came. It was the nature of things. And once he had taken the fatal step, well, he had to stick, that was all. Society ordained it. It would be degrading, would it not, for a respectable matron, the mother of a family, to slather her lips with rouge, her cheeks with powder, and swing her hips to induce a man to keep a vow he had already made to God? Of course there were men who walked out in spite of everything, and others who made their wives unhappy, the accepted euphemism for adultery. But there was only one divorce among the dozen members of the class. As parents, they were, how shall I put it, more human? They gave in here anyway to the possessive urge. I think they would all have agreed that a woman's first duty was to her babes. The most loving wife among them was certainly Milo Jessop. Yet mother used to quote even her as saying, when it was learned that Franklin Roosevelt had been stricken with polio, how glad Eleanor must have been it wasn't one of her children. And this sacred obligation to the issue of one's womb was stretched to embrace grandchildren. I had only to reflect on my own past jealousy of small nephews and nieces to gauge the extent of mother's concern for them. of their public lives, their relations to society, in the small as well as the larger sense. I shall have enough to say later. But I should like now to consider them in action, and how better can I do this than show them in one of their book lunches? I reach into the past for a sample, and the one that jumps to mind is at Mother's on a winter day in 70th Street, sometime in the mid-1930s. The book to be discussed is The Scarlet Letter, for only in later years did they confine themselves to current produce. And I, home as usual from Chelton School with bronchitis or asthma or even a heart palpitation, am watching covertly from behind the screen before the pantry door to the amusement of the two waitresses. Our butler, George, who would never have permitted me to eavesdrop, has been temporarily relieved of his duties on Mother's theory that a male presence might clog her guests' ease if a sexual topic were to arise. The ladies have gathered promptly at 12:30 in the parlour for sherry or tomato juice, and by 1:45 they are all seated in the dining room. It is agreed, in deference to afternoons presumably crowded, that they will be out by 2:30. The book will not be discussed until the second course. Soup is for a social catching up, and the sound to me behind the screen comes like a roar. The ladies all talk at once, yet all hear everything that is said. If there is any significant difference between the sexes, it may be that a woman can talk as she listens, while a man hears only himself. And now the soup plate's removed, a souffle is served, amid cries of, "Oh, Cornelia, one eats too well here." Hawthorne's masterpiece is introduced by the chairman, Justine Bannard, whose job it has been to bone up. A few dates and facts are given, and they are off. The voices come to me from across the decades.
The first book that the book class discusses that you mentioned is Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter. Did you have Hawthorne in mind when you were starting out writing the book class?
No, but it just seemed to me a very good way to start a novel about a book class set in a puritanical age of the terrible visitations of hell upon an adulteress in view of the relaxed standards of the book class, which yet seem rigid by ours.
Mm-hmm. And your narrator, Christopher Gates, is a decorator. How did you, decide that? Was it arbitrary, or did you have something in mind?
Well, it took a long time for me to fix on the narrator. He had to be younger. He had to observe them critically. He had to be entirely removed from them, and yet he had to be passionately interested in every detail of their lives. And a man who was that much interested in his mother's friends is not going to be the manly type that you wanted. On the other hand, I wanted him to be quite tough and sharp and brittle. But I never go into whether or not he's a homosexual, although it's obviously believed by other people in the book, or taken for granted that he's a homosexual. And the decorating life, for obvious reasons, seems to fit perfectly well with that concept.
Mm-hmm. And you've picked 12 women for your story. Are they meant to be a jury judging their class?
I don't remember thinking that deliberately. I think it just came out 12, but being a lawyer, it's very possible that that's just what dictated the number 12.
Okay, tell me about just the seeds of the book class. I mean, have you ever seen a book class?
Oh, indeed. My mother had just such a book class. Absolutely, exactly. And that's what gave me the whole idea for it. And it was run on they had the same number of people in it, and it was run on the same sort of principles, and it lasted for the same period of time.
You're of this society, and I mean, you were born into this society, and your background is there. Yet you have an objective light on you throw an objective light on these characters, and they don't always come off looking so good. Are you a traitor to your class? I mean, do you feel?
Well,
that?
I don't think there's a class to be a traitor to. I suppose there may have been some time in American social life where things were pretty well compartmentalized and people could talk in terms of loyalties. But I don't think that's true in my life. It certainly was true that term was used and very commonly used in the 1930s by President Roosevelt as being a traitor to his class. But most people regard it as rather nonsense even then. There isn't any. I don't know of any class that requires or expects loyalties anymore. That those classifications are far too loose, too fluid.
Mm-hmm. Well, your very early novels, your own family didn't want you to publish them. Isn't that right?
My mother had a fear that, also I was a lawyer, and she thought that she and father both felt that it would hurt my career as a lawyer, and that, and also they didn't for a long time take my fiction very seriously, and they thought I'd get a reputation of being sort of a sensational gossip writer and writing roman à clef about people they knew, and that I would not be taken seriously either by a literary or legal world. They changed their opinion on that, but they didn't think too much of my writing when I started. Indeed, they didn't.
Well, wasn't that idea, roman à clef, I mean, the idea that you would be betraying the people around you?
No. I don't think there was any sense in either mother or father of betraying any principles or class. I think there was a feeling that I might hurt feelings if people recognized themselves in books. And I know that they minded my novel, The Rector of Justin, because they felt, and they rightly felt, that a great many people at the Groton School would resent that book. And there were some who did. That's true. But neither mother nor father had any sense of defending a class, or even of really belonging to one.
Mm-hmm.
Father always used to insist that if we're any class, we belong to the great American middle class. And he even used to take us driving sometimes on Sunday afternoon, because he said that's the great American pastime. We'll go for a drive on Sunday afternoon. There he was, stuck in the back of the car for a suffocatingly boring drive, so the father could be middle class.
And today, do your associates have to be courageous to come to dinner party with you? I mean,
oh, that's nonsense. No, no, no. That was never true. That was never true. No, I think I'm regarded as a rather very extremely conventional person.
Okay, let's go back to this this class. I mean, there certainly is, and we're talking about, there is a society, that the colony club and...
Well, a class is a terribly important concept because it's so bitterly in people's minds. They never know quite what they mean by that, but they know something they resent. They know something that makes them angry, and it's always something that appears to exclude them. As they find out when they get into whatever the class is that they feel has excluded them, that it doesn't really exist. And the disappointment of the successful social climber is a notorious thing. But the sense of class is very largely in, it's kind of a psychic neurotic thing, which defined by the person who thinks he's being left out of something.
Well, that seems easy to say for someone at the highest class looking down.
I mean, assuming that I am, you see, but you beg the question.
Right. Well, are you not? I mean, from an old moneyed family in New York?
It's very hard to say if those, as I say, society in New York is such an enormously fluid thing that you would really have to write, in order to define accurately how people would fit in the constant going up and down, sideways, lateral movement of New York, the New York society, and the suburbs of New York. By the time you were through, you'd really have got almost each individual would be his own particular history.
Mm-hmm. But within Manhattan's Upper East Side,
that was less so in the 1930s, and probably less so in the 90s. But it certainly would be a very hard thing to define today. If you were advising somebody about how to be a successful debutante today, for example, you'd be in a terrible pickle as to what groups you would meet. If you had nice Yale and Harvard boys, which used to be very much the thing, you wouldn't find social register there. You'd have to look around all over the place for it. Mm-hmm. I don't know what you'd do. Then you'd find that it's the fashionable thing not to have a debutante party at all. And you find then in the sort of, I don't know what you'd call the highest society, but in the richest, most influential groups of New York City, are made up very largely by people who are not born in New York. In fact, 90% people who have made fortunes or married fortunes or made success in other fields and come together.
Is it, in fact, then, with this old generation dying, or will there be a new generation of society people with that sense, with a new wave in the country? I mean, will society come back with Reagan's America?
I don't think so, because It's possible in some places, but I don't think that in the turnover is so rapid today that I don't think that you would have a group of families living geographically close to each other over a period of two or three generations. So some sense of tradition and how things are done in a particular milieu could be established. I don't know. Certainly there's no place in around New York City where that would be true. And I wouldn't think even in Boston. Maybe there are towns in Texas where, with the colossal new fortunes made and the bulk of them being handed on with every kind of tax gimmick, that something like that is being established or could be established. But it certainly is not so in New York.
Why do you write? You've got your own career, and you're so prolific. And what's the motivation? If you were, again, coming from a society, a family, where you were comfortable, you know.
Comfortable, yes, but the Orgengross family, at least my branch of it, have never lived on inherited money. You can go back to five generations to my great-great-grandfather, who came over in the woolen business from Scotland, and each generation has supported itself, and they've left, in this branch, or some exceptions in the family lodge, have left very small estates. Each generation, I couldn't have lived on what I inherited, and my father couldn't have, and my grandfather certainly could not have.
But writing is so painful, I suppose. A writer like Joyce Carol Oates will say that she had the drive of the proletariat, like Dostoevsky, because to write.
Well, I think that's a lot of nonsense, if I may say so. It's so fashionable for writers to say that it's agony to write that the public expects it and feels rather cheated if it's not. And of course, the classic example is Anthony Trollope's sales falling off after his death when his posthumous memoirs were published, saying everybody thought it was such agony. And if he finished a novel by 11:45 and he had 15 minutes left to go, he'd start another. And that people thought that was absolutely awful, and they weren't getting their money's worth if somebody was churning them out like that. But everybody writes in a different way, but I hazard the guess that most of the writers that I've known in my life have enjoyed writing very much. Now, maybe Joyce Carol Oates doesn't, but look at her quantity. She must like it. I think she loves it.
So then for you, do the books come easily? Yeah, they must. I mean, you have quite a prolific backlog.
They do. They come with a certain ease, and I love writing, but there are awfully difficult moments in them. I mean, last year I wrote 150 pages of a novel, which I've junked.
Really?
Yes. Threw out altogether. It just wouldn't come at all. And that's a very painful experience. It used, when I was young, that was an agonizing experience. That was agonizing, not the writing, but the failure to write can be very painful. One thinks one then never go to write again. But now I've written enough, so when that does happen, I have a feeling that I will write again. So pain is diminished.
But when you began being published, you were already a lawyer. Why does one write when one has a whole other career, especially as a young man?
Well, that's because it is a compulsion. I mean, after all, you could think of people who've written all their lives without publishing. And look at Emily Dickinson. She certainly didn't have to write those almost 2,000 poems that she did. But it was necessary for her to do so, for her emotional content and satisfaction. And that's what it certainly would have nothing to do with. I mean, I think I would have written the same number of words had I had a trust fund and so was completely independent, didn't practice law as I did practicing law. In fact, I gave up the law for 2 years, and my writing, I did nothing but write. And I didn't even travel. I stayed in New York. And my volume didn't go up at all. In fact, I think I wrote less in that time.
Christopher Gates, the narrator in the book class, writes, "I saw in my lot the doom faces of males destined to the gray death and life of Wall Street."
That's what I used to feel.
And
I felt some of his thoughts are very much mine. I regarded women in the world that I grew up in as a completely privileged class, and men as kind of serfs. They made all the decisions. I mean, we always went to mother or grandmother, you know, made all the decisions and everything important. And it seemed to me that my friends' lives were that way too. That may not have been so, but I thought that was so. And then I thought men did dull, stupid, awful things down in, and they had to do that.
Mm-hmm. And why did you continue, once you were a successful novelist, to practice law?
Well, I liked it. I liked the balance in my life. I enjoyed the practice of law, and I needed the money, too. Enough about my writing is that I have made most money in my writing always the times when I needed it least.
Mm-hmm.
And my profession had been absolutely steady. I would have lived in a very different way had I been dependent on living on my writing. See, I haven't made that much. I mean, I did for some years. I used to have paperback sales, and I had one movie sale. It was very good. But I haven't had that kind of success, commercial success, in last years. I would have had a rather small potatoes had I been living on it.
What influenced you as a writer? I mean, is it... do you look at this as a novel of manner, or this is a novel of manners? And, you know, Henry James...
Well, I would say that The Book Class is a novel of manners, as that rather loose term is used. It would certainly seem to fit very exactly into that.
And does that...
I would not consider Henry James in the late style novels of manners at all. You might say that his middle style.
Mm-hmm.
The Wallstonians might, you might call a... I think you could call The Wallstonians a novel of manners.
And what did you... Is that the type of fiction you like to read? I mean, what inspires you in fiction?
Well, I vary a certain amount in what I read. You speak of Henry James. I mean, there's nothing left for me to read of Henry James. I've read and reread and reread Henry James again and again and written on him. I admire him enormously. I recently just reread Proust from beginning to end in the new Gilmartin translation, which is so excellent.
The style and subject matter seem anachronistic. Do you feel out of place at all in this writing?
No, it doesn't worry me at all. If you've got something serious to write, you're going to, that should be enough for you, and you're going to be recognized by enough people. I mean, look at the career now. There's just a book about her reviewed in this morning's Times, Ivy Compton Burnett. Can you conceive of a novelist more completely out of touch with the 30s, 40s, 50s, and so on, as we conceive them? And yet she had big sale and is regarded by many people as the foremost novelist of her period. And you can't, those are fantastic novels, all of dialogue between brothers and sisters, with nothing happening except a totally unexpected murder from time to time. You can't think of anything further away from the mainstream, but that didn't bother her. I mean, she knew it was her thing and she was doing it. So I don't think it makes any difference whether the style strikes somebody as old-fashioned or the topics strike somebody else as too limited. A writer has only his own tools.
Author Lewis Auchincloss. His novel The Book Class is published by Houghton Mifflin. For a list of available Movable Feast cassettes, write to In Our Time Arts Media, Post Office Box SS, Old Chelsea Station, New York, New York, 10113. Once again, our address is In Our Time Arts Media, Post Office Box SS, Old Chelsea Station, New York City, 10113. Funds for this program are provided in part by the Wittebinder Foundation for Poetry and by the Academy of American Poets. Theme music by The Minx. The mixing engineer, Manoli Wetherell. With contemporary literature on A Movable Feast, I'm Tom Vitale.
Local broadcast of A Movable Feast is made possible by a grant from A Movable Feast, located at the Northgate Mall.